Justice O'Neill is not sitting in this cause, and we're ready to argue the petitioner in C.B. Ingram v. Delgado.
May it please the Court, Ms. Block, who is presenting argument for the petitioner. Petitioner number 5, Tennessee.
Good morning. May it please the Court. There are two issues before the Court today. The first is whether an arbitrator has the authority to determine the underlying facts relating to the validity and enforceability of a mechanics lien. We believe that the answer to that question is yes, despite the provision in the property code reserving foreclosure, an order of foreclosure for the courts. But even if the answer to that first question is no, and that the arbitrator does not have the authority to determine the validity of the lien, or if there are other common law grounds for vacating this award, then the second issue arises. And that is whether a trial court, after vacating an arbitrator's award, has the authority to then simply substitute its own judgment based on the arbitrator's record. And the answer to that is clearly no. After vacating an arbitrator's award, there is nothing left to modify. The only thing that can happen, if there are appropriate grounds for vacating, and again, we submit there are not, but if there are appropriate grounds for vacating, the only thing a trial court can do is vacate the award, set it aside, and then either send it back to arbitration if the issue is proper for arbitration, or if it's not, tell the parties to go try the case anew in the trial court.
Ms. Block, do you have any authority for your statement in your brief that determining the validity of a mechanics lien and ordering its foreclosure are two separate steps?
Yes. The authority I have is twofold. One is from the cases that are out there, and there are only two, one of which is cited in my brief, and I apologize to the court for not including the more recent one that I missed and didn't put in my reply brief. I have given that case to opposing counsel, and that is Dalton Contractors, Inc. versus Brian Autumn Woods Limited, and it's found at 60 Southwest 3rd, 351. And in that case, even more specifically than in the Hertzshire Brayswood case that is cited in my brief, in the Dalton case, the court very clearly said the issues, based on a broad arbitration clause, similar to the one we have here, the issues relating to the validity of a mechanics lien can be tried by the arbitrator, reserving then the order of foreclosure.
But I don't think that Hertzshire talks about the elements related to the validity of the mechanics lien. It talks about the underlying contract issue.
That is true.
I mean, there is no mention in Hertzshire about dividing the foreclosure issue into two pieces and sending the mechanics lien over. What it says is that the trial court should have stayed the foreclosure proceedings pending the determination by the arbitrator on the underlying contract claim.
That is absolutely
so
correct.
You're taking it one step further than what the case actually does,
aren't you? And so did the case in Dalton.
Well, I understand that Dalton took it a step further, but Hertzshire does not support that proposition.
I agree.
Okay. I frankly
admit that.
To make sure I didn't read it wrong.
No. I do take it a step further because I think that determining the validity of the lien is part and parcel of the underlying contract dispute.
Well, but my question, let me go back again. Other than Dalton, do you know of any authority, just looking at the nature of a foreclosure proceeding in which we would treat the determination of the validity of the lien separate and apart from any determination about the underlying debt under the contract as being two separate proceedings?
And separate and apart from the cases, I think the authority for that is found in the property code itself. If you look at section 53.160, that provision of the property code establishes a proceeding, a summary proceeding, to allow a party objecting to the validity or enforceability of the lien, a procedure to come into court through verified pleading, and it sets out the parameters of what has to be done in order to challenge the validity of the lien. So there is a separate provision in the property code establishing the procedure for determining the validity of the lien. There is nothing in that provision that reserves that procedure for the courts.
But it's all in the same chapter.
It is all in the same chapter.
It's all the same chapter dealing with all of the provisions relating to foreclosure of mechanics lien.
Exactly. It is in the same chapter, which I think makes it even more clear that the legislature, in a separate provision, says foreclosure. The order of foreclosure is reserved for the courts.
Well,
then,
but,
in another... I'm sorry.
Well, this is a statutory procedure that is designed to effect the exception in the Constitution to allowing this kind of a lien in the face of a homestead, the homestead exemption, correct? I mean, this is which is why we're dealing with a judicial foreclosure.
Yes, although the statute is broader than just homestead.
I understand that it's broader than that, but that's really its origin.
Yes.
So you cannot do this by non-judicial foreclosure. You have to go to the court and get a judicial foreclosure by virtue of the way that the legislature has set out the scheme.
Correct, and that's why we didn't ask the arbitrator to order the foreclosure.
If we separate, though, the issue of the validity of the lien from the actual order of foreclosure, aren't we then reducing the act of the trial court, particularly given the tight parameters that are on a trial court under the Texas Arbitration Act, aren't we then reducing the act to a purely ministerial act in which the judge is just to put his or her signature on the final order?
I believe so. Although
so it doesn't that then cut against what the legislature intended in setting up an entire statutory scheme saying that we're going to leave it in the hands of the court to actually litigate and do foreclosure proceedings on matters under the mechanics lien statute?
Well, again, I think you have to look at what the legislature tell us. The legislature told us that the order of foreclosure, the actual order saying this lien can be foreclosed upon, has to come from a trial court. But again,
my question, I understand that that's what it says, but it's very clear that the legislature has set up in connection with that a scheme that is prescribed in the statute for how a trial court is to handle this and what is to happen and how a court is to do one of these judicial foreclosures. And if we buy your approach that we can tease out, and the only thing that the legislature was concerned about was a court signing the order as a ministerial act, then haven't we completely undercut this statutory scheme, which apparently the legislature decided needed to be handled by a court as opposed to allowing it to go forward as a non-judicial foreclosure?
I don't believe so. And I understand
that there's a
fine line there. But let me also point out that foreclosures outside of the mechanics and materials lien realm can occur by contract under deeds of trust.
Oh, I understand, but that to me is very significant that they chose not to allow that to happen here. I think that's an important distinction that they made at the point to say we want these to be at the courthouse with
well,
the judge
if,
involved.
If you have the other kind of a lien that's not involving mechanics and materials lien, say you have one under a deed of trust, the act of going down to the courthouse steps and foreclosing on that lien is one step. If a party wants to challenge the validity of that lien prior to going down to the courthouse steps, then you either go to court to litigate the matter, or if there is a provision in the contract between the parties requiring them to arbitrate all disputes, then I would suggest even in that situation you have to litigate.
But that's like litigating any other matter. There's not a statutory scheme that requires you to go to the courthouse in the first instance to get the foreclosure. I mean, I'm trying to understand. You have said to us we should take this foreclosure proceeding and treat it like two pieces. And I'm trying to see how that squares with the fact that we have a statutory scheme in place that the legislature apparently decided was important for some reason. And if we do what you ask, we will reduce the court's function to being performing a purely ministerial act of putting its name on an order of foreclosure without, in fact, litigating the issue.
I understand your concern about
and
that.
And I need for you to help.
Position.
Exactly. I wanted to lay that out for you so that you could help me deal with it.
The legislature has also told us how important it is to enforce arbitration agreements, and they've given us procedures for doing that. We have two, I don't think they're conflicting, but we have certainly have two different rationales and policy reasons behind what the legislature has done. And I suggest to you that the legislature simply did not have the arbitration provisions in mind when it set up the statutory scheme to require a court order in order to foreclose a mechanics lien. They weren't thinking oh, I wonder if these other underlying lien issues can be resolved by arbitration. But well, instead, they gave us a separate arbitration statute.
Given the parameters that there are in, or the limitations there are in the Arbitration Act for a trial court, in a trial court's reviewing of an arbitration order, what if we have an arbitrator who, in fact, is just plain wrong, and we have an invalid mechanics lien? Everyone knows that's the case. And in fact, just as flat wrong on that issue. And in the face of that statutory scheme, the trial court would have no choice, despite the fact that it was designated by the legislature as the appropriate adjudicative body to do anything about it. It must sign the order of foreclosure under the statute.
We have a very, very strong body of law in this state that prohibits trial courts from reaching a decision that is different from an arbitrator.
I understand. That's my
concern. Even if the arbitrator has made a mistake of law or of fact, except if you've got common law grounds for setting it aside or grounds for vacating it under the statute, which I don't believe are present here, although the respondent is certainly alleging that they are. So there are some procedures to safeguard the
process. But I had a hard time looking at the Arbitration Act, figuring out what conceivable exception could be applied if, in fact, an arbitrator had determined that an invalid lien was, in fact, valid.
Let me address that two ways. Okay. First of all, I want to give you some comfort level about the validity of this lien.
Well, I understand that you say it's a valid lien, but I can, in the time that you have left, can I get you to direct your attention to what options would a trial court have if it was faced with a decision by an arbitrator determining that a lien was valid when it was clearly invalid?
I think a party objecting to the or seeking to set aside the arbitration order in that instance would still nonetheless have to come within the grounds under the statute for setting it aside, or probably in the situation you've raised, again, which I don't think is present here, but if it's so clearly wrong, if there is such a gross mistake as to evidence bad faith or the failure to exercise an honest judgment, that's the common law standard, then the trial court would have a basis for setting it aside.
But I don't get to look at the common law standard if I'm under the Texas Arbitration Act.
Yes,
this kind of procedure would be under the Arbitration Act, wouldn't it?
No, I believe the case law is clear in Texas, and I haven't cited that, and I don't have any cases handy, but I have looked at that issue before, and my understanding is that the cases have indicated that the statutory scheme and the common law go hand in hand. They don't necessarily trump one or the other. And so a party can bring a challenge both under the statute and under the common law.
What conceivable? I can't find any ground in the Arbitration Act that would allow me, as a trial judge, to decide to not accept the arbitrator's decision on the validity of a lien that I didn't agree with. What ground under the statute? I couldn't find any.
Grounds for vacating.
Can you think? That's okay. I'm just wondering if you can think.
In this case, the ground that has been alleged is that the arbitrator exceeded his authority in making that determination. And that's an issue that this court has to decide, is does the arbitrator have the authority to make that decision? If the arbitrator does not, then that would be a basis for vacating.
Well, but your position, I thought, was that exceeding the authority goes to what the parties have agreed in terms of the extent of the authority given by the parties in their agreement.
That's the typical scope of authority issue, and that's not the one here, because there really is no dispute here but that the validity of the lien comes within this broad arbitration clause. The only thing that would take that out of the arbitrator's authority is the property code provision that states that only a court may order foreclosure. That's the only thing that would bring the validity of the lien determination out of this broad arbitration clause.
Conceivably, we could have a situation with a statutory mechanics lien that was invalid, having been determined to be valid by an arbitrator, and it's a lien against a homestead. And in fact, it would come back to a trial court, and the trial court would have no choice but, as a ministerial act, to sign the order of foreclosure, knowing that it was wrong.
Again, we've got to give deference to the arbitrators in the arbitration process. I suggest that perhaps if the legislature wants to go that next step, and give that additional protection to to homesteaders and say, we're not even going to allow the validity of a lien to be tried in arbitration, then the legislature is free to do that. But I suggest to you that there's no basis, given the statutory scheme that we have, there's no basis for preventing that from happening. Does anyone else have questions?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Sabrick will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. The one issue that I think makes this an easy call is Homestead. Last night I was on a plane talking to a lawyer, and he said, get in front of the court and say, Homestead, 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 and sit down.
Well, let's talk about that.
I didn't agree with him. I might agree with him afterwards, but I don't agree with him now.
Well, let's say that you do have an arbitration agreement between a builder and homeowners to build their home on their homestead. And the lien in their case, unlike this case, turns on very specific disputes. Was the work done? Were there proper credits and offsets? So the only dispute about the width of the lien is the amount of the lien, or maybe some other factual disputes, but it's a very fact-specific debate. And the parties agreed to arbitrate disputes about whether the work was done and that sort of thing. So you go through the arbitration, and the arbitrator decides what the facts were and says the lien is valid in this amount. Now, are you saying that you can still go to a trial court and you relitigate that whole matter? Was work properly done? Was it done in a good workmanlike manner? Were all the proper credits and offsets allowed? Do you get to relitigate all of that in the trial court, even though it was subject to arbitration, simply because the homestead's involved and lien's involved?
I think the underlying issue of whether there's a valid debt, how much of that debt is for, is right for arbitration. And for purposes of being before this court, that decision stands. That is, the court doesn't come in afterwards and say, well, the amount of money or the decision regarding whether there's a debt at all exists.
Even though if you won that, there wouldn't be a foreclosure.
That's correct.
And even if it were plainly wrong.
That's correct. What in this situation we have to protect is the determination by the arbitrator that there's a lien on this homestead.
Well, you go to the trial court and you say the arbitrator has determined that here's the debt, I have a valid lien, and I want foreclosure. And the homeowner says, oh, no, I agree there may be a lien, but it's not for that amount. You can't foreclose on my home for that amount. Now, where are you left? Does the trial court relitigate the amount of the lien or not?
I think in certain circumstances, the court should step in. But that's not the situation we have
here. Under that scenario, should the court step in? Could the court step in or not?
I think that if the arbitrator's decision violated the Constitution or violated a dominant public policy, the court should step in. And that's what happened in this case. That is, the court is not going back, and we're not asking this court to go back and say the amount of the debt was wrong. We're saying that they failed to satisfy the constitutional and statutory requirements for a lien on a homestead.
So you're going to draw the line between the debt. The arbitrator gets to decide the debt that the lien is attached to. But everything else, so what does that leave for the trial court to do? Then I get to walk in and I get to say, here's the debt. Nobody gets to look at the amount of the debt. Then what's left to be litigated?
Well, if the decision regarding the debt also happens to violate some constitutional ground or something against public policy, for example, the debt could be a gambling debt. And the court could say, well, wait a second, I'm not going to, there's where the line is.
Well, let's assume we don't have a gambling debt or anything like that. We're just talking about, like Justice Owen said, just arguing over how much was owed, how much work was done and how much was owed. That's all that was decided in the arbitration.
Then unless there's a statutory ground for overturning the decision about the debt, I don't think the court should step in and overturn that debt.
And then what would the trial court decide?
The trial court would decide whether the lien satisfies, whether the claimant has satisfied the constitutional and statutory requirements to have a lien on the homestead. So I do concede that whether the debt exists is subject to arbitration and shouldn't be overturned with statutory grounds. But I'm not before this court with some new standard to apply. A court must step in if the arbitrator's decision violates the Constitution or violates some dominant public policy.
Let me ask you, remind me, I have on these lands, on homestead lands, is there still a statutory retainage piece on homestead lands?
Yes. There's a whole statutory scheme.
Let's suppose that the only argument about the validity of the land was, did the contractor comply with the 10% retainage provision? And that's a very factual inquiry. And there's an agreement to arbitrate. So it goes to the heart of the validity of the land. But it's a very factual inquiry about how much work was done when, and when did the contractor retain or not retain. So that's all arbitrated. Now, does the trial court, can the trial court, when they go to the land is declared valid because retainage was met. Does the trial court get to relitigate that, or do the parties have to relitigate that in the trial court?
If it's an issue of violating one of the requirements.
Well, that's one of the requirements. You should meet the statutory retainage requirements.
Well, I respectfully disagree with the court. It's not a requirement in order to have a lien that the owner, who's the one to retains. That's a separate scheme in getting a lien on a property. There's a statute that says if you retain 10%, that lien may be limited. But there's another section in the property code that says here's what you have to have in order to have the lien. And you have to have some of the very requirements that both the trial court and the Court of Appeals went through. And they're both constitution and they're both statutory. And I do think that if we decide that arbitration on this issue of a lien on a homestead is going to be sacred, then we are just left with a ministerial task of a court. And I would suggest to this court that no judge should think that after signing the oath that they sign about protecting the Constitution should just be the rubber stamp for that activity.
You're writing, what I'm having a hard time with is you're writing the opinion. How are you going to say which piece of this goes to arbitration and which piece stays with the trial court?
Well, and that's an interesting way of doing it, because there are really two ways of looking at that issue. One is solely procedural. We have a procedure set up for arbitration. We have a procedure set up for foreclosure. And the court can decide this, I think much like the Court of Appeals decide this, as purely a procedural issue. That is, what are we going to let the arbitrator do, and what does it mean when the legislature said the foreclosure of the lien has to be done by a court? And you do have these two legislative statutes that come in place. And it's a very interesting issue. I think it's a more interesting issue when you don't have issues of homestead. When you have, for example, like you did in the Dalton case,
what does it look like if you do it on a procedural model?
What would the opinion
look like so that the next time a trial judge has to decide which piece to send to arbitration, the trial judge knows what to do?
I think it looks like this in a homestead case. You arbitrate the underlying dispute of what's owed, what are the facts, the arbitrator can make factual determinations that work was done at this time, or that this is the amount of money that was owed, or they didn't have the right to send them off the job. Then you go to the court, and the court's being asked solely to foreclose the lien, and the court has to check were all the requirements met in order to determine whether that lien has been satisfied. In our particular case...
But he couldn't go behind the decision. He just looks to see if those fact findings are enough.
I think that's correct. I think that if there were factual findings, for example, that a contract had been signed and there was a dispute about that, and the arbitrator found that there was a signed contract, for example, that had been filed prior to the time, that's a much trickier issue of whether the court can go behind those factual findings. Again, we don't have that in the present case. The arbitrator concluded there was a lien.
A little confused. We're not talking about a contractual case, aren't we? We're talking about a statutory mechanics and materialness lien filed by a sub. Is that right?
Filed by the general.
By somebody who's not the owner.
That's correct.
Was it based on the contractual mechanics and materialness lien between the general and the owner?
Well, in the arbitration, they moved for foreclosure of their lien. And that didn't come out of what lien they were and what they weren't moving for. They moved for a termination of that lien. The court ultimately decided that they didn't have any lien at all, because the requirements for a mechanics lien contract in connection with a homestead still have to satisfy the various requirements that you need in order to have it. So I know there's been some arguments about the fact that no mechanics lien contract was decided, but in fact, If you don't have all the statutory requirements for the statutory or constitutionally, you don't have a mechanism.
Again, let's suppose you've got a very broad arbitration agreement. I signed an agreement. So anything that you would possibly relate to might be construction of this home, we're going to arbitrate, and your rights against me, et cetera, et cetera. It's very broad. I signed the contract. The home is built. The contractor says, now I want to be paid. And I said, well, I'm not going to pay you. And he says, well, I'm going to foreclose my lien. I said, well, I have a common law husband, and you didn't get him to sign the contract. So we go to arbitration over whether I have a common law husband or not, and whether he signed the contract. Now, do we relitigate that in the trial court if I lose?
I think if it's a matter of protecting the Constitution, the answer could be yes. And look, the United States Supreme Court and even this court have recognized that this is a balance.
We're just talking about forms, aren't we, in arbitration clauses? Isn't that what the U.S. Supreme Court said? We're just talking about the form where disputes are resolved. What's so different about that dispute? Do I have a common law husband or not? That takes it out of the arbitration statute.
What takes it out is the homestead nature of the property and the fact that the court has to step in and say, am I going to decide that the legislature in this arbitration scheme overrides the Constitution and that the legislature intended that by signing an arbitration agreement you potentially gave up your homestead rights? What's the duty of the court to step in? And the answer to that is the court has a duty. Now, how far that duty goes, does it go to looking behind the factual finding of the arbitrator? I would suggest that in certain cases, the court may have to do that.
What cases? Judge Hankinson asked what? You say, don't look behind the desk. Look behind common law marriage. I'm not sure I see a principle there, but if we had some more examples, maybe it would help us.
I'll give you an example. So there's a case from this court in which two spouses had to sign the contract, and only one signed it. And one got it, signed it, but not in front of the notary. And this court said strict compliance.
Okay, but what if there's a factual dispute about whether one signed it or not?
And if there's a factual dispute, and two different people could differ onto it.
Well, the Pope and five people say she did, and she says she didn't, and the arbitrator says she didn't. That she did.
I think the court should give deference to the arbitration in that factual finding. I don't have a problem with that. But the underlying fact can be left to the arbitrator. And I don't think that for a judge that it is, they have to balance those interests.
Arbitrator decides, no, she didn't sign it, but that shouldn't matter in this case, that's something the judge should look at again.
I think that's right. And I'm not saying that it's an easy task for a judge to do, but the question is, are we going to empower trial judges when it involves an issue of public policy to even make that determination?
You think this is this way because of the homestead issue that's involved.
And if,
for example, an arbitrator can't order garnishment, but he can say, well, you owe $10.
That's correct.
And then you go to the court and you get the garnishment. And you wouldn't let the court look behind that, and the court would just have a ministerial duty to enforce the judgment by execution or attachment or garnishment or whatever. Once the award was confirmed, but because this involves homestead, you think it's different?
I think it's different, and I'm not the first person that's been before either this court or the United States Supreme Court. I'm not creating law here.
Well, have you looked at other jurisdictions in terms of this kind of an issue and how it interplies with arbitration?
Yes, I have. Again, the United States Supreme Court in a series of cases has looked at this issue and has said that a common law basis, both under federal law and under state law, has a limit. And that limit is when the arbitrator's award violates public policy. It's interesting, most of the Supreme Court cases were labor cases, labor-related cases, and I've got some cites for the court on this issue.
Well, would you mind submitting a supplemental brief?
I'd be happy to.
That would provide that to us. Do any of those cases or cases from the United States Supreme Court or other jurisdictions deal with this kind of a situation, where you're looking at something like a foreclosure proceeding or something similar to that, where you're saying we ought to split and send part of it over and leave part of it here?
I don't know if there's any that split, but there are many, including a decision of this court, that says we do have, a court does step in when a contract violates public policy. And I think the issue here that comes out is whether the decision that a homeowner might owe money or the factual determination of the arbitrator doesn't cross that line necessarily into public policy or the Constitution. But if those findings do, and if that award does, then the court has an obligation to step in.
And so in your view, too, to take the petitioner's further point, you don't think there's anything for the trial judge to try. He's just looking at the facts that have already been found and deciding as a matter of law whether that justifies foreclosure.
And that's what the court did in this case. The parties agreed to limit the evidence that we were going to submit as the arbitration record. In this case, we had a full-blown arbitration record because there wasn't oral testimony. And the court looked at that record and said, okay, as a matter of law, here's my checklist of what I have to have to have a constitutional lien. They didn't satisfy that checklist. Therefore, it is my job to say that that lien is invalid.
Well, it seems a little bit inconsistent, though, for you to take the position that we don't want the trial court to just do a ministerial function, but to then confine the trial court to just the record on the arbitration. If, in fact, the trial court is going to determine the validity of the lien, then why isn't Ms. Block correct that, in fact, the issue should have been open to the trial court, not to relook at fact findings, but for them to be able to say, see, here's our lien, and here are the various requirements, and here's how it was met.
And that becomes a matter of procedure.
Do you agree with her that this should go back to the trial court if we decide that the trial court should have done more than just sign the order of foreclosure?
Not in this case. And the reason is we had that hearing. We had that trial. The lawyers on both sides said, what we're going to agree to submit to the court is the arbitration record. If you do not have the arbitration record, or if there is some other evidence that a party has present and wants to submit, then I think that the court should take
I thought that's what happened in this case, that there was an effort to put additional that evidence on, that during the course of the hearing, someone went downstairs to the clerk's office, to the property records or whatever, in order to bring up, to show the court what the record was.
Never made it to the courtroom.
Mr. Savary, this sounds a little bit like you're trying to say, if it's a constitutional issue, we treat this like an agency decision. It's not an arbitration. It's sort of like a substantial evidence review. If there's some evidence supporting the arbitrator's decision that this agreement was entered into before the materials were delivered, then that's the court must accept that finding. But if there's no evidence supporting the arbitrator's decision that this agreement was entered into before the materials, then the trial court cannot confirm the arbitrator's word.
And
is that really what you're arguing?
Well, I'm not arguing it because it doesn't matter in our case. That is, in our case, there was no findings of fact by the arbitrator that the trial court's decision went against. There was only really a conclusion of law. I think you have maybe a more interesting issue than we have when you have a trial judge who is going to change the finding of an arbitrator. And what the courts have said on this is that this is tough. This is a balancing issue. This is balancing two interests that we have.
But the record, you say, is the record from the arbitration hearing, and you're asking the court to review it. And I'm trying to – it sounds to me like what you're saying is that that what's going on here is a substantial evidence review. And that's what we ought to be doing.
For this case, it really is a no evidence review. We don't have to get to whether substantial evidence is the test to apply, because in this situation there was no evidence at all in the arbitration record or at the proceeding in front of the court that they satisfy the element. So you don't have to say, well, there was some evidence or in which the arbitrator could decide that. In this particular case, and our position is, there was no evidence whatsoever, and that's what the Court of Appeals decided as well, that there was simply
under binding arbitration, the court would play no role in looking at the evidence at all. And so I'm trying to figure out what it is you're really saying the court should do because of the constitutional dimension. You're not saying that they ignore the arbitration award. You're really saying that in the constitutional dimension here, the court plays a role in evaluating the record before the arbitration to determine if it's enforceable.
And that's the question we have. Does the court even have a role that goes beyond just the ministerial?
You're basically saying there's a heightened standard of review above and beyond what the arbitration access.
Correct, when it involves constitutional or public policy issues.
Any other questions? Thank you, Chairman.
I want to talk about the Constitution and homesteads for a moment. Mr. Savert has argued that this is violative of public policy because the lien awarded violates the Constitution. And I want to point out to you that that is simply not the case. That was certainly not the basis of the Court of Appeals decision. There's nothing in the Court of Appeals ruling indicating that this lien in some manner violated the Constitution. The constitutional provision merely requires that in order for a mechanics lien to be valid, there are two requirements. It has to be a written contract, and it has to be signed by both spouses if the spouses are married. Those two requirements were clearly met in this case. And
if one of them wasn't met, and the arbitrator said, well, I think the lien's valid anyway, could the trial court do anything about that?
Well, that's a tougher call that this court need not reach, and I think that would go to the...
Just so we'll explore all these things, what's your take on that?
I tend to agree that if you've got a constitutional argument and a strong public policy argument, then maybe that's where the court should step in, but that is not the case here. We don't have a constitutional violation. The only basis for the Court of Appeals determination that this lien was somehow defective had to do with the statutory scheme. And again,
well, isn't that the public policy argument?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that the second argument you make, that what the legislature says is required to perfect the lien in order to foreclose it is a public policy declaration by the legislature?
Well, I don't believe it is, and to the extent that it may
well,
be,
don't
it's
we
not...
always say that the legislature is the one that does public policy?
Well, again, the legislature has told us that it's strong public policy in this state to have issues resolved by arbitration.
I know, but that's the next question. Do we actually have a conflict between two statutory schemes, and if so, how do we resolve it?
No, I suggest that we don't. There is no conflict. And admittedly, when you're dealing with a homestead, an argument can be made that there should be strict compliance with the statutory requirements, and that is
well, that
an
is
argument
the argument
to be
that's made, and it's because that, the statute says so. Don't you think that's public policy?
Well, and to the extent that that is an evidence of the legislature's public policy, I think that is an argument to be made to the arbitrator. When you're telling the arbitrator, you've got to comply with the statute strictly because these issues have been agreed by the parties to be submitted to arbitration. Again, you get back to the first question. If the arbitrator had authority to address these issues, then there is no basis for revisiting those factual disputes, those factual findings that were resolved by the arbitrator.
Well, then, would your argument be that, in fact, there is an uncoupling between the validity of the lien and the requirement for a judicial determination in order to foreclose under .160?
Yes, I believe there is, and again, we've got the Hershire case, but more specifically the Dalton case, which does specifically address the validity of the lien as being a separate step that can be submitted to arbitration. Once the arbitration is concluded, then if the party has won the declaration of a valid lien, then they go to the court to foreclose. Also, though, as I pointed out earlier, the authority for that division is found in the property code itself, where it has a separate provision for determining the validity of the lien, and there's nothing in that provision that says it's solely within the province of the courts to make that determination. I do want to talk just a little bit more about
does that. When you cited 160, I gave you the wrong. Yeah, that's the procedure to object to the lien's validity.
Correct.
And that's part of this whole chapter.
It's part of the whole chapter, correct. And in that chapter, the legislature has said which parts are reserved for the courts, and it's silent on that provision. And again, that is the only thing that could possibly take this dispute out of the arbitration, which again is a broad arbitration clause. I suggest to you that the homestead distinction is irrelevant here. In fact, in section 53.154, which is the provision that says only a court may foreclose a mechanics lien, there's no distinction there between a lien on a homestead or on commercial property. So Mr. Savitt's procedural model of how to tell the trial court which part to send to arbitration and which not doesn't have any basis in that statutory provision. He wants to somehow exempt from arbitration any time you've got a homestead involved. He wants to exempt that from arbitration, and there simply is no common law or statutory basis for doing that. I suggest to you that the entire concept that there are some issues that are so important that we ought to not ever allow an arbitrator to rule on them is foreign to the jurisprudence of this state. If the legislature wants to tell us which issues can't be submitted to arbitration, that's one thing. But the courts have never done so.
Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument today. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
All right. Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.